You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
McLovin touched on this about Chris Mortensen. Mort had a report. I'll give you the tweet here. Would not report the Eagles have internal unanimity on Hurts's QB1, but sources say the boss, Jeffrey Lurie, has instructed his group to prioritize making Hurts successful in 2021 as opposed to creating true competition. And then here's one reporter, Les Bowen, who covers the Eagles. If the Eagles really are sure about Jalen Hurts going forward, that's a conclusion they have come to very, very, very recently. I don't think he's produced any new tape to evaluate. Well, that's the approach I would have. I haven't seen enough of Jalen Hurts where I go, here's the keys to the car, and it's an expensive car. I'm not doing that. I want to see a little bit more with Jalen Hurts. Man, we have this rush to judgment. In the case in point, and I'll get to Tim Kalishaw, but, you know, we have this, we did this with Deshaun Watson, and I think we're doing it with Justin Fields a little bit, where we've seen a lot, but that's, we've seen too much. Therefore, gosh, I got to get somebody we haven't seen that much of. You know, I'm starting to like Zach Wilson a whole lot more. Okay. I think we're overthinking. We overthought Deshaun Watson. I think we're overthinking Justin Fields. It's, you know, Mitchell Trubisky. You know, this guy nobody knows about. Daniel Jones, nobody knows. I'd like to know a whole lot more about my quarterback. Let's put it that way. Not, I don't know, this guy. It's like the less we find out, the more valuable they are. That's not the case with this guy. The more we find out about him, the more valuable he is. He's Tim Kalishaw, Dallas Morning News columnist and star of ESPN's Around the Horn. If I talked to you yesterday,
yes,
what would you have said about what the Cowboys were going to do with Dak Prescott?
I gave it in the morning a 10% chance they would do anything other than just franchise him today. So I was off by 90%, I suppose, on where this thing was headed. But I talked to a couple people who cover the team on a daily basis, and they were a little higher than that. They were 15 to 20. So there wasn't a lot of thought this was going to get done.
Was yesterday a good day for the Cowboys?
That should be an easier question to answer. Yes. I'm going to say yes. But it's not a great day for the Cowboys. It's a great day for number four.
Yes.
It's a real good day for him. You know, I just think there's realistic concerns. These numbers are real. The teams are not winning or going to Super Bowls with quarterbacks making 35 to 40 million. I mean, Tom Brady wins most of them, but even if you took out the ones he's won recently, the quarterbacks that would have won the game would have been Goff in his first contract or, you know, Mahomes again. And so it's the guys, it just gets really hard to build a roster. It's not impossible, but it's tough. They have a green light for this year. They have a $22 million salary cap figure for Dak this year. That's good. That's going to go up quickly. And you know, and then in 3-4 years, they're back at it again with it. So this is kind of a one-year window. Okay, do something in 2021.
My question is not about, you know, Dak as much as it is that defense. Unless their philosophy is we're just going to outscore people, because that defense has been an embarrassment.
I think the philosophy will be in between those two. I think they're hoping Dan Quinn, by coming here, you know, brings the Seattle defense from 7 years ago with him, not the crappy defense he had in Atlanta as a head coach most of the time. But that's a coaching change. They need personnel. They need pass rushers. They're going to have to draft corners. They know that. So again, they're kind of doing what they did after Dak and Zeke's rookie year when they went 13-3 and they rebuilt the secondary. They got rid of Brandon Carr and all the veterans and said, we're going to draft Awuzie and Jordan Lewis and these guys. And so you're counting on that. The defense has to help. You can't win. You can't just sit here and say, we're going to score 33 points a game. That's not realistic.
I was also wondering about this. You know, Dak is coming off a broken ankle.
Yes.
It
people don't like to talk about that.
No, but I do. I watch the video, Tim. It's real.
It is.
He didn't get hurt at the bargaining table with a broken ankle, coming back from a broken ankle.
No. And that's shocking to me. And I've written about that a number of times. You try to put it in a nicer way as possible, but realistically, this guy was, he was 5 rushing touchdowns a year. He was a threat to run. He's more like, you mentioned Deshaun Watson a minute ago. He's more like that as a runner. He's not Kyler Murray or Lamar, but he was a threat. And he also, because he's big, he would try to run over defensive backs a little bit. And now, having experienced what he did with Logan Ryan, is he going to back off from that? Is he strictly a guy who's in the pocket? And how does that change his value to the team? Nobody has that answer.
I also wondered about this. You've written about this. But if Jerry had signed Dak Prescott 2 years ago, he would have gotten a bargain, I think. But then would they be in a similar situation in a year where Dak would be signing up for even more money with this new TV deal, and that he would be ready to go, you know, back on the market?
Well, yeah, if they'd have signed him 2 years ago, I think they would have, the extension would have lasted as long as this one does. They would have redone the last year of his rookie deal and stuff. So at some point, yeah, he's going to be, if he's a successful quarterback, he's still going to have some prime years left, clearly, when this contract runs out. So they've got 4 years. They got 4 more years of him, and they got to do something. At that point, that's 9 years. That's 9 years for Zeke. That's a lifetime for a running back. So they've got to, you know, you were just talking about quarterbacks. The other starters in their division are Daniel Jones, Jalen Hurts, and I guess Taylor Heineke at the moment. I mean, you know, Dak is beyond head and shoulders above that group. They got to make that count. They got to do something with that. Yeah. They can't keep wasting these years.
Are the Cowboys in a Super Bowl over the next 4 years?
No. I'll say they're going to end their NFC championship drought, 25 years without one. They'll get to that in the next 4 years, but if I'm sitting here making a prediction today, there's a lot that has to go right with this team and this coaching staff and this head coach to get to a Super Bowl. They're in better position by being in the NFC looking ahead than the AFC. Almost all the good young quarterbacks other than Kyler Murray are in the AFC. And that's where it's going to be a dogfight to get past Mahomes and everybody for years. They're in a little better fit there, but there's still too many good teams. Green Bay's got years left. Lord knows Tampa Bay's got years left with their quarterback. So they have a chance, but I would predict no.
Is Dak Prescott a great quarterback?
He's a really good quarterback. I would say no. I'd say he can be, but I would say also year 6, is he likely to suddenly get better? I don't think so. But what we saw the first 5 weeks last year, surrounded by really good talent, he could lead the league in passing yards and win bigger playoff games than he has. But he you don't look at him like you did Aaron Rodgers 10 years ago and say, or Russell Wilson after 4 years, and say, this guy's great. You say, this guy's good. You got to keep him. You got to put people around him, and let's see what happens. He hasn't proven greatness yet.
If you could get rid of one contract on the Cowboys right now, which one would you get rid of?
I would get rid of Jalen Smith's, and although that's not that bad a contract, I think he counts $10 million this year. They're okay right now. I think they've always, 3 of their top 5 contracts are offensive linemen. The top 6 contracts are offensive linemen, and that's hard to put that much money there and not put any in the defense. And here I am taking a defensive contract away. I just think linebacker being the position it is, that's the one I would probably remove. I don't think they have any terrible deals. I wouldn't take away DeMarcus Lawrence just because his sack totals are down. I think he's still an important player. But they have got to have a great draft, which they're pretty good at, and they've got to somehow make this defense middle of the road.
You feel bad that we won't be talking again for a few years?
Well, we have Luka, Danny.
What's there to talk about?
He's pretty good. That's another team that needs to build around a guy who's pretty good, except he's more than pretty good. It is a little sad. Writing at least one Dak contract column a month has been kind of a toss-up for 2 years. Because it's always gone these different directions. And like you said, the Cowboys could have done themselves a big favor. And I still think of Stephen Jones saying 2 years ago, we're not going to set the market. Great, great plan. We'll just have the market run over us. We'll just have it steamroll us. And we're going to give a guy $40 million, and now people are mad here because he got too much money.
Yeah. Were you secretly rooting for Russell Wilson to come to the Cowboys?
I didn't spend more than, despite your intrepid reporting, which got this whole thing started, I didn't really spend more than 5 minutes on that. I think Seattle would be insane to trade him. I would have been different. But no, I didn't really punt that as much as I could have.
Yeah, that's good. That's smart on your part. Tim, thanks for joining us as always. And we'll look forward to your next appearance on Around the Horn.
That's today. Today's Dak Day.
Oh.
So if I can't win today.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, what am I doing here?
Wow. You're right about that. Well, we'll be rooting for you, Tim, as always.
What's a good FaceTime, I wonder? I haven't even thought of that. My gosh.
Oh, you're already thinking about winning?
Not usually at 8:30 in the morning, no.
Thank you, Tim. Tim Kalishaw, he's calling his shot. And you know Tony Reale is watching right now going, oh, Kalishaw calling his shot on the Dan Patrick Show earlier. Boop, 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 boop. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com. Or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app.
Hey, this is Jason McIntyre. Join me every weekday morning on my podcast, Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre. This isn't your typical sports pod pushing the same tired narratives down your throat every day. Straight Fire gives you honest opinions on all the biggest sports headlines, accurate stats to help you win big at the sports book, and all the best guests. Do yourself a favor and listen to Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I can't run down the resume. It's too long. All I know is one of the great people I've ever met in this business and Hall of Famer, Dr. J, Julius Erving, on the program. Doc, how are you this morning?
Hey, Dan. I'm good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. Last time you dunked?
Last time, I was 63 years old, 71 now. I've never been incentivized since since I was 63. So, you know, what the hell?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, at what point do you go, I don't need to, want to, or it hurts too much to try to dunk?
It hurts too much to land after the dunk.
How old were you when
I have sons who play a little basketball. And, you know, one is 6'6", and the other one's about 6'3". So I enjoy watching them do it as opposed to me getting out there messing around.
How old were you the first time you dunked?
Oh, man. You know, I cheated. I was in elementary school, and I was on an 8-foot basket. And I had a small basketball. So I was doing all kinds of tricky stuff. I think a lot of the stuff that people saw me do on a 10-foot basket started on that 8-foot basket and then progressed to a 9-footer. And then eventually got to be a 10-footer. So my 10-foot dunk shot, my dunk on a 10-foot basket was probably at 15, you know, 14, 15, somewhere in there.
But who did you look up to when it came to dunking? Because I was trying to think prior to you, unless it was guys playing in the Rucker League or Connie Hawkins or some of those guys, who was the guy you looked at?
Well, in my neighborhood, Roosevelt, Long Island, small community, 15,000 people. When I walked to school every morning, I had to go past the house of Jumpin' Johnny Green. And he played for the Knicks. And Johnny wasn't a high scorer, but he would get a lot of tip-ins and tip dunks. So when I was blessed to go with my Salvation Army basketball team to a Knicks game, and sit in the obstructed view seats in the old Madison Square Garden. So you had to look around a pole to see what was going on down on the court. I would see Jumpin' Johnny Green, and you know, he was very inspirational to me, as was, you know, Wilt Chamberlain and the great Elgin Baylor.
Well, I remember Jumpin' Johnny Green with the Royals. And I think Johnny played at Michigan State, but he wasn't a tall guy. But, you know, when your name is Jumpin' Johnny, you better be able to jump really high.
He's like 6'5".
Yeah.
He was 6'5". You know, they probably listed him at 6'6", as they did back in the day. It always gave you an extra inch, you know, just put a cushioning in your shoe and the socks. And but he was the nicest guy. And he became a franchise owner, McDonald's franchise owner, I believe, after post-career, hired some guys from the neighborhood. And I used to always visit his place and see him. He always greeted you graciously and with a smile. He was just a super guy, man. He was a super role model to have.
I guess I've taken this for granted, but I don't remember how you officially got your nickname Dr. J. I thought it was from a high school friend, but can you tell me that story? After all these years, I don't think I've ever asked you how you got your nickname.
No. There's two parts to it. One, initially it was just the doctor. And I had a buddy, and I called him the professor, and he called me the doctor. And we had professional sounding nicknames. His real name's Leon Saunders, Kwaku Leon Saunders now. And we finished at Roosevelt High. We go to UMass together. So the nickname spread a little bit while I was in college, although it was never totally publicized. And then after college, when I signed with the Virginia Squires, I started playing in the Rucker League. Name got more popular then because I had an immediate impact on pro basketball in the summer. And then when I went to camp with the Virginia Squires, they had about two or three guys in the organization who they just called Doc. You know, so if you yell Doc in a certain room and three docs were in there, everybody turned around, are you talking to me? So my trainer said, you're going to be Dr. J because we got Charlie Scott here and we're going to promote you guys as Charlie the Great Scott and Julius Dr. J Irving. And it has stuck since that time. That was 1971.
What were you called in the Rucker League? What was your nickname there?
They tried to lay a couple of nicknames on me. You know, you might have heard they wanted to call me the Claw, and they wanted to call me Black Moses. And the guy who was announcing the game, you know, the games went on in perpetuity because, you know, they always held the clock back. That's why the scores were so high in the 150s, 160s. And he would just amuse himself and pluck a name out of the sky and say, oh, man, the Claw has hit the baseline again and dunked another one, whatever. So I had to go over and say, if you're going to call me anything, just call me the doctor, because I didn't really like the other name.
Yeah, Black Moses is like, you can't go home, you know, and say, you know, to your family, you know, it's, I don't want you to call me Julius, it's Black Moses now.
No. And I didn't want the whole Harlem community calling me Black Moses either, thinking I was a messiah. It was going to save him.
Did you ever, I don't know if you ever fought this. I was fortunate to see you play against the Kentucky Colonels, I think was the.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I always wondered because we viewed you as a dunker, but I don't know if you fought that label of being just a dunker, even though you were far more than that, but that's how we came to really realize who you were. But when you went to the NBA, were you fighting that, hey, I'm more than just a dunker?
It's a good conversation to have, because I always prided myself in having an all-around game. You know, when I retired from basketball, I played professionally for 16 years. And as it turned out, I was third leading scorer, only behind Kareem and Will Chamberlain. They weren't all dunk shots in terms of steals, blocks, scoring, rebounding. Now, maybe in the top 20 in rebounding, but top 10 in all three of the other statistical categories. So I don't think you get those type of stats from just being one dimensional. And I've seen some guys, you know, who were just dunkers, and they got a breakaway dunk. I mean, they were satisfied that they had done their job. and that's all they just brought me in the game to get a dunk shot and then, you know, sit back down. You know, my job was to lead, to be inspirational to not only my teammates, but to the fans, be a coach on the floor. And do a lot more, and then after that's done, do some more. So I approached it as a job, and tried to have a really good work ethic that would inspire others. And even, you know, when I was hurt, you know, many times I played hurt. I think after the first year or second year, you know, nobody doesn't have some sort of pain or some sort of agony associated with an injury that's just not going to heal. So, you know, so I'm not a big load management promoter with load management these days, because so many guys did play hurt and felt as though, hey, if I sat down, somebody was going to come and take my job.
Did you ever feel bad for Michael Cooper with that dunk? In the NBA,
Michael and I were, hey, I was on his podcast last week, and you know, we yucked it up a little bit about it. Since we both coach in the Big Three, Ice Cube League, you know, we've been able to make amends. You know, he's been really cool about it, because he said it keeps him relevant to the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. Because he was posterized on that particular day, and I kind of agree with him.
Well, did you think that was more impressive, or the one where you went baseline and came up underneath in the NBA Finals?
I think definitely the baseline move. You know, that was truly floating on air and creating. Using some body control, using the big hand to hold the ball out of bounds. And then, you know, force of nature, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was standing under the basket, and it froze him for a second. Because, I mean, it's something he probably could have easily have blocked, but he didn't know what was going on.
He didn't think you were going to get to the other side.
He was a little dazed and confused at that time.
What's it like to fly?
It's a good feeling. it's a good feeling. Dan, you know, actually, you know, it started on the playgrounds of Long Island, just getting in the swings and going back and forth and hitting a pinnacle and then jumping out, going forward and soaring in the air and learning how to land, jumping off of a seesaw, playing on the park benches, stepping up on the bench and just jumping and feeling free. There's a freedom of expression associated with soaring. And then there's an extra benefit if you soar and you score.
Is there a better dunker than you in the history of the game?
I think there's some guys who would been more impactful. You know, I mean, I'm probably on the Mount Rushmore just as an innovator and opening the door for a lot of people. And that's the way it should be. I mean, I think, you know, the first guys in, Connie Hawkins and Elgin Baylor, and, you know, I mean, so many guys who used to throw down, Johnny Green, before mentioned. you know, they open the door for the next generation. So I would expect that, you know, there's been three generations since, if we count generations as 10 years since I played, this is the fourth. And if you don't see improvement, you don't see better dunkers, then what's going on with these guys? You know, once they see it, they see it's possible, and then they can tinker with it to make it better. So that's just a natural progression of things, I think.
Did you think you were better than Jordan at any point?
In the beginning, you know, it was interesting because when he came out of college, and we actually, he and Dominique Wilkins went to an event in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was a golf event, and we ended up getting in the gym and playing some basketball, you know. So I saw what he had, but I also knew what I had and whatever. So, you know, it was like he was a junior version. But as, you know, time will tell and the story will be told. I mean, that's a six-time champion, six-time MVP or whatever. He certainly surpassed my accomplishments, almost doubled, you know, in championships because I had three runner-ups. And I'm like the Gary Player who says, you know, I won the Masters five times and I was runner up five times. He had to include that. Like, that's pretty important when you come in second. But most important, if you validate, you know, your presence and your career by getting over the hump. And that's why it was such a challenge for me, you know, from 1971 to 1981. You know, with all the accolades in the ABA, it was important to be MVP in the NBA in 81 and then champion in the NBA in 83, because, you know, there are some people on the other side of the tracks who only look at that side of it.
We're talking to Dr. J, the Hall of Famer. Coolest thing in your office is what?
Coolest thing in my office? I got some stuff in here. You know, I mean, I got an Emmy for the doctor, our documentary. I got a nice Lalique statue of a golfer, which is, you know, one of my passions and my favorite pastime these days. And once I get my shoulder healed, I can't wait to get back out on the course. I have a trophy in my office that looks like a Heisman trophy. And it was given to me by the Dallas Mavericks the last time I played in Dallas, because I was in the game that welcomed them to the NBA. And upon my retirement, they created this trophy, and it's really cool.
Well, you certainly got enough awards there. Did you keep everything? Like, do you have all your honors?
No. I didn't keep everything. I think Bill Russell's the only guy I know who has kept everything, because I've been to his house a number of times, and, you know, he's got all 11 championship rings in the 13 years.
Does he show those off, though, Doc?
It's in a trophy case. You got to walk by it if you walk into the house. So that's probably the best collection that I've seen of a former player. For me, I actually had an auction maybe about 5 years ago. So I think the wonderful home that I'm living in right now is a testimony to parting company with the stuff.
It's great to talk to you, and hope you're doing well. You look good. I don't know how, you know, the golf game is going to be when you come back.
Yeah. How's yours?
I took a 7-year hiatus from the game.
What?
Yeah, my body. Yeah, I had some problems health-wise, and I love it, but I had to step away for 7 years.
Yeah. And I think it was prior to 7 years we were on the golf course together.
Well, that was.
I wish to see it back out there.
That was like 97. No, that was in Utah, 97. Maybe.
I don't know the exact year. You know, you have a lot of people around you who
can keep the holy timeline. They don't know anything, Doc.
People are only worried about today.
Yeah. All I know is I dunked on you. I mean, that's right. That's all I know is I dunked on you.
It came up. came up.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of like the legend in your own mind comment.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not lying when I say I dunked on Dr. J, am I?
Yeah, I'm not the only Dr. J out there.
you were the only Dr. J on that slab of concrete that day. We lowered the basket to 8 feet, and I just said to Doc, would you stand underneath the basket? And he's like,
yeah.
And then I took off to dunk on him, and I said, I'm good. I just dunked on Dr. Yeah. Doc didn't even know what I was doing at the time, so I apologize.
I tried not to go like this,
It's great to talk to you as always, Doc, and thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Hey, you got a great show. Keep it going.
Thank you, buddy. That's Dr. J. Dr. J. Looks good, man. But it's been a little while since he dunked. Yeah, pretty good golfer, too. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR, or stream us live on the Peacock app. Dan Orlovsky, the great analyst for the mothership, NFL Live, continues daily throughout the entire offseason at 4 Eastern on ESPN. Catch Dan with Adam Schefter, Marcus Spears, Mina Kimes, Laura Rutledge, 4 p.m. Eastern daily on ESPN. Dan, thanks for joining us. Did the Cowboys have a great day yesterday?
The Cowboys did not. Dak Prescott did. Dak Prescott's family did. But this was a big time swing and miss for the Cowboys. I think that they took a calculated risk. You know, they tried to be patient and didn't want to do something like the Rams or the Eagles did. But man, that is a ton of money to give Dak Prescott.
What should the expectation level be for Cowboy fans this year?
Oh, this year at least you're talking second round of the playoffs, sniffing your NFC championship game. You know, like this is what my comment is with this. And it's the old saying, too much is given, much is expected. This is why I was very cautious of giving Dak Prescott a ton of money or second most quarterback money. It's going to impact your football team. And we can't now sit here and say, well, he's really good, but the expectations stay the same. The expectations have to be elevated, not only individually. Hey, when our left tackle's out, we still have to win the game on the road against the New York Jets because they stink. Or when we don't have Amari Cooper, we still got to play good at the position because you're supposed to be a difference maker when it comes to the finances. It's a bad division. I still have to wait to see what happens in Washington at the quarterback spot. If they got a quarterback that I thought was a good player, a Ryan Fitzpatrick, I think that I would favor them to win the division because I think Dallas still has issues defensively, offensive line wise, and overpaid at tailback.
Other than that.
And good luck trying to fix those over the next 4 years.
Well, that's my point with all of this is I don't like Zeke's contract. The offensive line is not what it once was. And you got guys got paid up there. The defense is one of the most overrated units in football right now. I'm not sure about Mike McCarthy. I mean, and Jerry's not, you know, Jerry's what, 79 years of age, Dan? Like, there's no rebuild. He thinks he reloads here, but I'm with you. People might put the Giants ahead of the Cowboys going into the next season.
I would, but here's my thing. I need to know where Saquon's health is. I said this 5 minutes ago. If you gave me Ryan Fitzpatrick with Washington and you gave me an offensive lineman that was a quality offensive lineman there and a receiver outside of McLaurin, I'll take Washington. If you told me that Saquon Barkley was completely healthy, that Leonard Williams is going to get franchise tagged in New York and you got a receiver to replace Golden Tate, I'd take that New York over them because I think that they're a better run football organization. I believe in Martin Mayhew in Washington. I think that they're better coached football teams and they're a healthier team, 1-53. The roster doesn't have the stars potentially, but it's healthier. Dan, last year with Dak healthy, they were 2-3.
Yeah.
They were 2-3. And in the first half of those games, Dak threw for 4 touchdowns and had 4 turnovers. Then everything hit the fan. But, like, it wasn't like they were playing awesome football when he was healthy. They were just so down so much that the stats got padded. He threw for 1,000 yards last year when they were down by more than 2 scores. So I get it. It's a day of celebration for Dak Prescott, but don't kid yourselves thinking that this is the difference between mediocrity of 20 years and now being a Super Bowl legit contender.
The other thing that hasn't been factored in, I don't think nationally by the media, is Dak is coming off a broken ankle. He didn't lose anything at the bargaining table, Dan. If you came off knee surgery or you came off a broken ankle, I'd feel more confident you coming off knee surgery than a broken ankle. I don't know if you ever had a broken ankle, but at that position, and I do ask him to run a little bit here, it doesn't feel like that's being played up enough.
Yeah, I mean, I broke my ankle the last game of my 2011 year on the road against Jacksonville, and it lingered for the rest of my career. It wasn't as severe as Dax. Now, he's a significantly better athlete, all that stuff, and player-wise. I mean, we have to realize, though, too, no offseason last year, and people can tell me it didn't hurt. Go watch the games. They were very average to below average offensively in the first half. Then it became a complete throw it everywhere against prevent defense. No offseason last year. This year, no offseason again, and you're gonna have to do it in the midst of rehab, okay? You're gonna have pieces on your football team because there's still $3 million over the cap. So, well, who's going to take the hit? Someone is going to have to get moved or take a hit or something like that. You're going to have to develop some of your young players. And so the fact that you're going into a second straight year without an offseason with an injury, you don't know what he's going to look like in a game till you get him in the preseason. And you're probably going to be hesitant to play him a ton.
We're talking to Dan Orlovsky, the ESPN NFL analyst. A couple other things here. I think you tweeted the silence is deafening with Russell Wilson. Maybe I'm paraphrasing here. What do you think is happening, or what do you expect to happen?
Yeah, it reminds me of the Carson Wentz situation in Philadelphia like that. Fired coach, new head coach, nothing getting said. Russell hasn't said anything. It's the easiest time ever to say something, right? And he's only thrown gasoline on the fire. I think there's a lot of layers to this, Dan. I think it starts with Russell Wilson wants out of Seattle right now. I think Russell Wilson has a vision 15 plus years from now to be the Magic Johnson of the NFL, the first guy to go from player to like big time kind of brand business type of guy. I think he realizes that's not going to happen in Seattle for him. I believe that he wants to go to a bigger market. 9 years, really good football, never gotten an MVP vote. Okay. Really never really thoroughly been into the conversation up until this season. I think he's tired of playing for a defensive minded head coach. I think he wants to be the focal point of a football team, both, you know, literally and schematically, so to speak. Mm. And I think that I think that there's a little bit of a heat check. You know, I say this all the time. Quarterbacks have egos and it's why they become who they are. But I think he's going, I think I'm great and I think I'm powerful. And he's right. Let me find out if Seattle sees it the same way. Let's find out if Seattle views me the way same way I view me. And I think Seattle's starting to warm to the idea. You know what, Russ? We're not going to play your game. We're not going to let you be bigger than us. That's why they sent out those letters and he's not on it. Come on. I think Pete Carroll's going, nope, I'm not going to let you play that way.
Yeah, the letter they sent out to season ticket holders talked about DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, and they somehow left out a future Hall of Famer. In Russell Wilson.
Exactly.
Yeah. No message being sent there. I think it comes down to ego. I think it's Pete Carroll versus Russell Wilson and, right. You know, last man standing, and it's going to be Pete Carroll. But if one, you know, now the Cowboys are off the list. I wonder if Russ expands the list a little bit, Dan, because I can't see the Bears offering anything that Seattle's going to go, oh, okay. You know, maybe the Raiders. You know, I get Derek Carr and something. The Saints, I don't see that happening. If I'm Russ, I really want out. I think I got to expand my my wish list here.
Yeah, you'd have to. It would be silly not to include New York and Miami, right? If you really wanted out because they, you know, those are two teams that have multiple first round picks in this year and next year's draft with the Jets included in that. So you'd obviously want to that. I think Seattle has to ask themselves two major questions. Do we believe that we can win this way, a Super Bowl? Because they've got multiple experiences. They did it and won the Super Bowl when Russell was cheap, and then they paid him, and they haven't been able to replicate that. So they might sit back and be like, you know what? We tried it this way. It did not work. We actually want to go back to doing it in a financially flexible way. And the second thing would be this. how do they replace him? How do they replace him? Because you can't just go, well, we'll trade you. You've got to find either the player or the capital to go replace the quarterback position, whether it's a rookie or something like that. I only would say this caveat with the Chicago one. His brother lives in Chicago and his brother works in Chicago, and they're desperate. We as human beings make stupid decisions when we're desperate. And you could take Chicago and go, listen, Matt Nagy and Ryan Pace, if you don't get Russell, you're fired. You're True. More than likely fired for next year. Yeah. So give us your next three ones. And I think that's something that Seattle would have to find worthy for consideration.
Why is it that we love the unknown at the quarterbacking position? That we did this with Deshaun Watson, where teams talk themselves out of Deshaun Watson because they go, we've seen everything from him. We like the unknown, like Mitchell Trubisky or Daniel Jones. And it feels like we're doing that with Zach Wilson, who was – he had to beat out somebody to start this past season, whereas Justin Fields has been there in front of us, and it feels like we might be treating him the way we did Deshaun Watson. Explain this logic to me when it comes to quarterbacks in the draft.
Yeah, two things. When you go to the grocery store, there's a reason why the candy bars are at the checkout aisle and they got shiny wrappers because it catches our vision. That's a legit thing, you know, like – and I feel like we sometimes do that with quarterbacks. Shiny object. I got to get it. It looks cool. And we've kind of fallen into that trap in the NFL. While we've seen the infusion of athleticism at that quarterback spot come into the NFL, we still scout the quarterback position backwards. We look at defensive ends, wide receivers, offensive linemen, linebackers, physically first, then mentally, because that's what's necessary. There's a certain requisite size, speed, shape to play those positions. That's secondary for the quarterback spot. The physical attributes for the quarterback will always be secondary. You have to think fast. You have to play fast. You have to have remarkable leadership. You have to have incredible study habits. You have to have great vision. You have to have the intellect to handle all that information and then be physically good. But just because you're physically good, if you're mentally poor, it's going to catch up to you. And I think that Zach Wilson's that guy that you see like physically so impressive. We've got to figure out where he is intellectually. And I think that people are looking at Justin Fields and going, well, your receiver was open a lot that Ryan Day designed for you. And I'm like, so what? Like, that's the job of the coach to get people open. And then the job of the quarterback is throw it to them. I've got multiple examples of Justin Fields going from the second to the third, you know, pick or read when it comes to that stuff. But at the end of the day, Patrick Mahomes has opened our eyes to a different type of quarterback that we want, that we crave, that we think we can get. Zach Wilson looks a lot like him.
Always great to talk to you. Thank you, Dan. I always learn something. You can watch more of Dan in the morning with Greeny on Get Up and also ESPN NFL Live. Thank you, buddy. We appreciate your
time.
Thanks,
bud. Be safe. Right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app. Darren Revelle, sports business reporter for the business of sports betting, senior executive producer of the Action Network. And I wanted to have Darren on for a couple of reasons. The digital world of sports collecting with cards. Also, a lot of these cards, you know, we're finding out Mike Trout rookie card or LeBron or Tom Brady. They're going for over $1 million. NBA Top Shot. There's a lot of questions here. And that's why we bring in Darren with the answers here. Let me start with the NBA's Top Shot. So exactly what it is it, and how did it start to explode into many, many millions of dollars for these photos?
Okay, so Dan, if you have a 1952 Mickey Mantle, do you own the photo?
I own the card.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that's the way to think about it. You own the one of those cards, and you have the right to sell one of those cards. It's the same thing with Top Shot. You have a highlight where there's 49 that have been given out, and you own one of 49. You have the right to sell that one. You don't get dividends if it plays on SportsCenter or if someone runs it on YouTube. You don't get any credit. You only own the right for that one. And so just like cards, where there are limited edition cards, there are a limited edition of these highlights. You get them out of digital packs and you have the right to sell them. Some of these have sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now the question is this a real market or is this a market that, listen, we're living in a world where crypto is 24/7. You wake up, you lose $12,000, you gain 12. We're living in a world where people pumped up GameStop, you know, a company that has age-old popcorn ingrained in their carpet and made them a blue-chip company. What is real? I can't tell you what is real.
But who gets the video to allow you to get the snapshot? Who owns the video of
the NBA owns the video. The okay. NBA creates the content. And then Top Shot, a company, Dapper Labs is the company that makes it, puts it in the pack. The NBA owns the video, just like whoever took the photo owns the video owns the card. So the NBA owns the video. There is no question about that. But it is on the blockchain, so it is secure. You own that particular right to sell, and then you can sell to someone else. And by the way, here's an interesting point. The NBA, because it's on the blockchain and it's secure, the NBA knows when you sell it to somebody else. And when you sell it to somebody else, they get a 2.5% cut. So anytime it's sold, all the way down the line, they get a cut, which makes digital collectibles, as long as it stays healthy, more important than a physical collectible. Because once you sell a card, the league isn't getting a cut of it anymore.
I'm trying to think what's the most famous piece of video that would be in a card in NBA history. Like what is available? You know, LeBron's block on Andre Iguodala in the NBA Finals is pretty famous, or Kyrie Irving.
That's the thing, right? Like a card, you don't know what game it's from. People have never, like Michael Jordan, his 86 Fleer rookie that is lighting up the world, that was from a random Nets game in 1985. So like, you know, this allows you to connect to a highlight. And by the way, they haven't really opened up the past. Like, what would a 1988 Jordan dunk contest from the foul line highlight sell for? And are they even going to be able to sell them? You would need Michael Jordan.
Why do I need Jordan if the NBA owns it?
Because the NBA owned it at the time, but Jordan would have to approve of it now. Because he's not part of the Players Association.
Oh, okay. Explain to me the recent physical card phenomenon where, like, who's driving this? That, you know, we know Mickey Mantle seems to come up every other year or something. Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, Mike Trout, a Tom Brady rookie card. Who's behind all of this?
I think it's what's behind all this, Dan. I think it's that in COVID, we're looking for nostalgia. We're looking to reach back at times when things were normal. People are going through and cleaning their closets. Their parents are cleaning their closets. They're finding things. And finally, this is the key. We need some excitement in our lives. We need some dopamine to be rushing through our brains and body. Go try out an eBay auction. See when you win an eBay auction, it's an immediate rush. It's almost like it. I'm telling you, it's not only about the card. It's about the feeling it generates when you win an auction. And so it becomes addictive in a way. Why sports gambling up? We need to juice ourselves up because we're sitting at home with, for me, for God's sakes, I got twin boys in first grade right outside my door. You know, it's like, what?
Yeah, but you're not going to spend $1 million on a Tom Brady rookie card just because
I'm not going to spend $1 million, but I've spent more money than I've ever spent in my life in the last 8 months.
What have you bought?
I bought what's the most expensive thing I bought? I bought some serious stuff. I bought a Mike Tyson 1986 Panini sticker. Those things are going for $60,000, $70,000 in some conditions. I bought a Jordan rookie. I had to have it, 86 Fleer. You know, so people are buying. And a lot of it is the feeling it generates. And the camaraderie, right? Like when you buy it, there's a collecting community that you then share. It forces you to have relations with people, not in the Bill Clinton, not in the Bill Clinton relations, but, you know, relations.
But if you're looking at getting into this, can you dip your toe into this, or do you have to go into the deep end?
No, it's very risky, right? Because you have to know who's controlling certain markets. So, like, I'll give you an example. One of my friends who has plenty of money says, I want to do Luka Doncic. And I say, well, you got to be careful because Luka, 21 to 25 year olds who don't have the same net worth as you, they're going into Luka cards. And what happens is if the market starts to crash, they're going to sell Luka, and then that market will crash before everything else. So I tell people, try to figure out who's in what you want to collect. And it starts with you have to like what you're doing, right? Like, not all markets are going to stay up forever. I know that's a crypto thing, and oh, it's just going to go to the moon. Everything's going to go to the moon. It's going to all go up. Everything, never, nothing ever goes down. Don't start with that philosophy because you're going to get in trouble.
But we've had, you know, Mike Trout had a rookie card. That why is it one of one? I never understood that they only make
one. It's a false scarcity, right? So, like, they decided to create this Mike Trout super fractor where it was the lotto ticket. It was the Willy Wonka. And so did I ever think that was going to sell for $3.9 million? No, but we've created this whole false scarcity. If you remember, Dan, in the 80s and 90s, the reason it crashed is because they told us that the Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card was limited edition. Then we found out it was the most produced card of all time, and these guys were running off sheets of Ken Griffey Jr. to pay for their pizza using it as currency. So, like, we needed to create a false scarcity. And so that's what the card industry did. This is one of 49. This is one of one. And if you pull that Willy Wonka, you then get it graded. And then there's a whole grading industry. So, like, you get a Michael Jordan in a one that was run over that you actually put literally in the spokes of your bicycle. And that in the worst condition is going to sell for $4,000 now. But if you have a 10, that's $615,000. So the one thing that I hate, Dan, is when someone goes, "Ooh, I have this card." And I'm like, it doesn't matter if you have the physical car. If it's not a tent, like,
I know.
Oh, so that that's how it's working.
I had somebody who works for somebody who's pretty famous in this business, and he was asking me, you know, if I collected cards, and I said, you know, I got them, but I don't know if they're worth anything. And I said, you know, my son's got Pokemon cards. He went, wait, which ones? Which ones?
The Charizard?
Yes.
The Blastoise?
And I said the Charizard. And he goes, you got to take pictures. Like, how many do you have? And I go, I don't know. My son has them in a notebook or a scrapbook. He goes,
a binder.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? You're like, I have a 1961 Wilt Chamberlain Fleer rookie. And he's like, oh, okay. He's like, but my son is Pokemon. Oh, my God. Like, it's almost like disrespect. You know, like, you care more about a fake dragon than you care about Wilt Chamberlain rookie. Like, this is messed up. This is messed up.
I had to take my phone out and open up the scrapbook for...
You were doing a live
yes.
viewing of what...
Yes. And then you could hear the disappointment in the guy's
voice. Oh, that's not a first edition from Japan. Forget about it, Dan. I'm sorry.
No, he goes, look at the edges. Oh, the edges. Oh, they're not done. Those aren't good. Okay. Yeah, those aren't worth anything. And I went, okay. So that was my foray into possibly being in that world for a split second.
The hardest thing that I do every day is people texting me saying, I got it. And I'm like, that's not the one. It's in horrible condition. You know, and it's all, you know, it's just in the end, it's just disappointing for a lot of people.
This is crazy. The most expensive card ever bought, is that the Pi Trainer one?
Mickey Mantle's now a Mickey Mantle 9 from 1952 Topps sold for $5.2 million. There are three 10s, and all those people are not selling. It's believed that that would be a $20 million card. The great part about that is in 1952, Mickey Mantle was number 311 in the set. It was the high number series, so it was the second set that they came out with. And in 1952, people were disinterested after the first set. So from 1952 to 1959, Topps tried to sell those things for 2 cents a card. Couldn't do it. So they took a lot of the cards and went in Staten Island and dumped it on a barge into the ocean. and that created a false scarcity or a real scarcity. And then the rest put it in bicycles, and the rest, the moms threw it out. So my favorite line, by the way, is, I wish my mom didn't throw it out. And then I remind them that if their mom didn't throw it out, it would be worth nothing anyway. So,
Darren, great to talk to you, and good luck with the twins.
All right, take care.
That's Darren Revelle, the executive producer for the Action Network.